Dave's Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
You will see Mark's posted there for both tests. Let's see how you guys did. Marks went up, which they don't tend to, actually, for the second test, so it's pretty good. So today we're going to talk about something that probably when you first started taking psychology, first signed up for this class, you probably thought you'd never hear about, because almost all this stuff is not going to be about the humans. It's going to be about non-human animals. So we're talking about learning, and the question, of course, you could ask at the beginning is, what is it? My favorite definition is from a guy named Bob Roscorla. You'll hear his name a lot today. He's at the University of Pennsylvania, really bright guy. And he says that some event at time one influences behavior at time two. Because there's some experience, if you want. Events a little more, I guess, yeah, it's shorter, that's all, so it sounds better. So, yeah, I know, technically, you could say if I, you know, I don't know, let's think of something like broke your knees with a baseball bat and you couldn't walk, that would be one event at time one affecting behavior at time two, and all you've actually, it didn't affect your walking. You didn't learn about walking, you learned that I'm a jerk that hits people in the knees with baseball bats. But really, you can think about this as almost anything from like, oh, I don't know, something like, you think about, you know, the Pavlov dog kind of example, right? A tone, and then food in the mouth, and eventually the tone at time two makes saliva happen. Or something as complicated as you sit in a class at time one and learn about calculus, and at time two, you can do differential equations. So it could be, it encompasses a lot of stuff, and that's why it's a nice general definition. It's as good as any definition, as I said here, and it's better than most of them that I've seen. So, and Bob's smarter than me, and very famous, so I will go with Bob Roscorla's definition. The two simplest forms of learning are habituation and sensitization. And you'll see that these, even these really simple forms, fit this, some event at time one influences behavior at time two. What these involve are repeated stimulation, repeated discrete stimuli. So they're individual stimuli. Okay? And then you get, with habituation, you get ignoring the stimulus. So if I, a repeated stimulus, like if I clap my hands like that, see, get a little startle reflex, and we actually measure the startle in, like, say, a rat or a cat or an aplegia, which is a slug that has 2,000 neurons, or a nematode, which is a little worm that has 302 neurons, probably the simplest animal with a nervous system. The animal then starts to basically ignore the stimulus. On the other hand, sensitization is, with repeated stimulation, the animal pays attention to the stimulus. There's a bigger reaction. Again, these things show up in everything from the simplest things with nervous systems, like an aplegia or a nematode, to something like us, the probably most complicated thing with the nervous system. That's pretty much all I'm going to say about these things, habituation and sensitization, except that if you do take the learning course, we spend 2.5 weeks on these. Because it's actually the basic kind of learning, and if you can study it in something that you know all the neural circuits and you know the genome, you might be able to understand the genetics of learning, which is pretty cool. But that's the simplest forms, and they show up in all kinds of animals, everything from aplegia to the humans. So, but it's really, frankly, for our purposes, kind of uninteresting, right? I mean, it's boring learning. It's a loud sound, and the animal doesn't pay attention or pays more attention. So let's talk about something that's a little more, probably something you might have heard of, actually, which is classical or Pavlovian conditioning. This was discovered by a guy named Ivan Pavlov. Pavlov was a Russian physiologist. He won a Nobel Prize for physiology and medicine, so he was pretty good. And Pavlov basically, he had, we all know that the world works this way, that if you put food in your mouth, you salivate. We need saliva to help start the digestive process. It doesn't just lubricate stuff and make it go down the throat faster. It also has enzymes in it that start to break down things. Okay? There are low concentrations of enzymes in saliva in mammals that start to break things down. So if you put food in your mouth, you start to salivate. Right? It's like when you chew gum. It can make you feel a little less thirsty because you start to salivate, right? Now, he had it set up. He was studying these animals and these dogs, and he had basically tubes going underneath their snouts, okay, to collect the saliva. And he was putting, he had an automated system where food was delivered into their mouths, and he was, the saliva was collected. He wanted to see how much saliva was produced. And when, one of those great serendipitous things in science, what ends up happening is that they didn't put enough food in the machine one day. There's no more food, but the machine's still buzzing. It's going bzzz, because it was doing that. It's a mechanical device every time the food was delivered. Pavlov looks, and it's still collecting saliva every time the thing buzzes. Everybody thinks it was a bell. It's not a bell. It's a buzzer. It's a myth. It's a bell. I don't know where the myth comes from. It was a buzzer. So remember, if you can take away two things from the class, Freud was a loser, and it was a buzzer, not a bell. There's two things. So this buzzer happens, he gets salivation. And in fact, you think about this, this will happen with you if right now you imagine something you like to eat. Just the imagining there will make you salivate. Right? You'll get spit in your mouth. You think about pizza. You like pizza. You start to salivate. Pizza, thinking of pizza, is the same thing as the buzzer in Pavlov's experiment. The buzzer itself then elicited salivation. Okay? It's pretty cool. So, yeah, love this picture. Of course, they're using a tuning fork as their what they call the, well, that's not really what it's called yet. First, unconditioned stimulus, okay? The unconditioned, meaning no learning yet. Unconditioned response, you put food in dog's mouth, dog salivates. This one doesn't show the tubes going up into the dogs, and it's held in a harness. This was, remember, in the early 1900s. But before conditioning, if you play a tuning fork, again, not a buzzer, an automated food feeding machine, but this would work, to the dog, you get no response. Right? You are wired up, and so is a dog, such that when you put food in your mouth, you salivate. It's an unconditioned response. Now, during conditioning, you get the tuning fork, let's say in this case, and the food together. First the tuning fork, and then while the tuning fork is playing, you give the food. You get salivation. Now, after the after a bunch of these pairings, we'll call these pairings or trials, you get a response. That's called a conditioned stimulus, because the dog has now been conditioned, right, that the tuning fork leads to food, which then leads to salivation. So do you understand the basic premise of this? You might have heard of Pavlov's dogs before, but do you understand the idea of a Pavlovian response then? Make some sense? You good? Okay. Very good. So some key terms here. UCS, unconditioned stimulus, leads to a UCR, or an unconditioned response. After conditioning, a CS, the conditioned stimulus, will lead to what's called a conditioned response. These are very similar, by the way, with the Pavlov experiment. That's salivation. So is that. The UCS, remember, is the food, because it's unconditioned. The conditioned stimulus is the tone, the buzzer in Pavlov's actual experiment. In our little graphic there, it's the tuning fork. Okay. Again, do you understand that then? Do you see the terms? By the way, it's called conditioning because of a mistranslation from Russian. Pavlov called it conditional responding, which makes more sense, because it's conditional on the pairings, but it was a mistranslation, and they call it conditioned. And that's why we call learning conditioning now. It's just a little tidbit there, a little conditioning trivia. So the CR, the conditioned response, is very often like the UCR. They're both, in this case, salivation. It's usually not as strong. And the strength of the response here would be the amount of saliva the dog generates, and it's going to be less than you would get if you actually put food in the dog's mouth. Okay? And again, that makes sense. If you think of pizza, you salivate some. If you actually have pizza in your mouth, you're going to salivate more. Right? Okay. Questions so far? You're good? Make some sense? This happens in almost everything that exists, just like habituation. Everything that's an animal. Sometimes the strange thing that happens is it's what's called preparatory. A preparatory conditioned response is the opposite of an unconditioned response. This happens sometimes with drugs. If your body is ready, if you're about to, well, let's back up a bit. If you inject heroin into your body, you get a rush. That happens. There's other effects as well, of course. Nothing nearly as fun, but you get those. If you think of the needle when you take heroin, and I know you all take heroin. That was a joke. You think of the needle as the conditioned stimulus. As soon as a junkie sees a needle, their body gets ready for heroin. Indeed, as soon as the person who's a junkie goes to a place where they always shoot up, their body gets ready for heroin. This actually explains why if people go to a different place to shoot up, they often end up, they think, oh, I need this much of a dose to get the effect. But their body isn't ready for that big a dose. It would only be ready in the same room. And they end up giving themselves overdoses. Okay, so you get these preparatory responses a lot with drug conditioning. Weird and wild. Okay, but usually we're going to talk about something, the same type of response in the same direction. Preparatory responses are just the opposite direction. Some people, I titled the slide Spit and Twitches, because one of Barbara Scoreless' papers about classical conditioning says, it's all spit and twitches, why is it interesting? Well, it's not just that. The conditioned stimulus has to overlap in time with the unconditioned stimulus. Okay, it has to overlap in time. So if I was to draw this up, a little graphic here. So there's your conditioned stimulus. And the unconditioned stimulus is like that. So these are like that. You see how they overlap in time? It's not that as one starts... Sorry, it's not that you wait for the CS to end, then you do the UCS. As the CS is being presented, partway through you present the UCS. If you actually do have a gap between the CS and the US, that's called trace conditioning. It's not nearly as effective. Because think about it. What does the end of the CS predict for the animal? It predicts, wait a while, then the UCS will come. So it's not going to be nearly as effective as when they overlap. You can also do something really strange, and you can do the UCS first, then the CS. That's called backwards conditioning, and that clearly isn't going to work very often. Because again, think about what the animal, what's being predicted here. The CS being presented means the UCS is over. Think of the animal kind of being, though Pavlov didn't think about it this way, think about the animal being kind of an active participant in its own learning. The animal actually is sort of, I wouldn't say thinking about it, but representing how the world works. This is really, all that classical conditioning is the animal to, on very small timescales, predict the future. So that's not going to work very well. Okay? Does that make some sense? You good? Okay. Conditioning usually takes many CS-UCS pairings. It doesn't happen after just one. It wasn't just one time with the buzzer and the food powder. It was many, many, many times before Pavlov got the buzzer and then that makes salivation happen. Usually takes quite a few pairings. Okay? How many depends on what kind of thing you're doing the conditioning with. And we'll talk about different approaches here shortly. All right. Okay? So, at the beginning, when the animal is acquiring, there are different phases of learning. When the animal is acquiring the pairing, acquiring the CS-UCS pairing, we call that acquisition. That's at the beginning where you're giving CS-US. I'm going to start saying US because no, outside of intro books, no one calls it a UCS. They always call it a US. I don't know why they do that in intro books, and it drives me crazy. So, CS-US, CS-US. How do we know the animal's still acquiring the association between the CS and the US? Because if we just played the CS by itself, the animal doesn't salivate a whole lot. Okay? And then you do it after the next trial, it salivates a bit more. After a long period of acquisition, or not so long, depending on the preparation, responding levels off. I've always said this, you can't salivate more than salivating as much as you can. So eventually it levels off. We call that asymptote, and those of you that are with a little bit of mathematical sophistication realize that's what a curve does when it levels off. Right? Basically, again, the animal can't, think about the dogs, they can't spit any more than the most they can spit. So it levels off. We're measuring learning by how much they're spitting, how much they're salivating. If we now pair the CS with nothing, so now we've got asymptote, now what we're going to do is we're going to do the CS by itself because we want to see if there's learning, and there is, and it's all great. Let's do that a whole bunch of times. Just buzzer, 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 buzzer. What's the animal learn now? The animal's learned that the CS predicts nothing. So it stops salivating. That's called extinction. It's funny, whenever I teach this stuff, I get all conscious of how much I'm salivating. I'm talking, it's really weird. Probably shouldn't have shared that. That was a little odd. Now the CR disappears. Eventually the animal's like, okay, and again, the animal isn't thinking this, but the animal now is predicting the future again, moment to moment. Oh, that tone doesn't predict, that buzzer doesn't predict anything. I'm not going to salivate anymore. Remember, though, this isn't a conscious sort of process, just like it isn't in you. If I say pizza to you, you start to salivate. You don't think, oh, maybe he would bring pizza. I should start salivating now. Right? Just happens. So you go back, let's say a day later. So you've done this. You've gone through acquisition, asymptote, and then you've stopped. You've got, so acquisition, asymptote, extinction, experiment's over. Next day, you take the animal in. Hook him up again. Give him that CS. He actually will respond. See? Spontaneous recovery. This is just the CS by itself. See, so there we are. There's acquisition. There's your asymptote, nice and level. There's your extinction, CS by itself. Next day, so look at this. It's 22 trials this took. 24 hours later, bring the animal back in. He's salivating again. So you get responding. Why? I don't know. And I'm not alone. No one really knows why this happens. Either functionally, in other words, what function it serves. Maybe the animal's like, well, maybe the world's changed again. The other thing is, physiologically, we don't know why this happens. It just does happen. Someone will figure it out. So that's called spontaneous recovery. All right. This may, in fact, be, I know, the most boring lecture you've ever heard. Imagine taking a whole course in it. The same thing, by the way, happens in habituation. So just if you went back to that, the idea of just playing a regular stimulus. So it's beautiful. You get these same phases of learning. All right. Good? Questions? Okay. Whoa, that all came up at once. All right. A few more key terms here. Once we have conditioning, we can get what's called generalization. So let's say instead of using a buzzer, we were using a tone, and the tone was 440 hertz. Is that a C, or is that an A? It's 440 hertz. So we're going to play the animal a 440 hertz tone. So we just draw this up. So 440 hertz, which I think is a C. You play that, and then you give food. 440, food. 440, food. And you test it, and let's pretend that at 440 hertz, it salivates that much, whatever that is. We can also play 440, 460, and we get less. Right? We could also play 420. 420. And we get that much. And then we could play, oh, I don't know, let's go with 480. Down here, and that would be what, 400 then, right? Down here. So you get this sort of almost like a normal curve shape. That's called generalization. The opposite of this, by the way, is called discrimination. You could... So 440, let's call 440 the S plus, stimulus plus, just meaning that we give a stimulus and then we give the food. Okay? Now we're going to change that. We're going to do two sets of pairings. 440 is food, and 460 is going to now mean no food. What we're teaching the animal is 440 is good, 460 is bad. What's now going to happen if we test this? On this side, we still get this beautiful generalization. On this side, however, the curve would drop off because the animal's now learned that there, you don't get any food. That's called discrimination. You're basically just teaching the animal there are two different... This is one of the ways we can see how accurate an animal's hearing is. This is how we can detect if animals can see different colors. Right? So you can see, teach them that if let's see if they can just tell the difference between red and green. If we teach them that red means food and green doesn't mean food, if they can learn that, they can see color. If they can't learn it, they can't tell the difference between red and green. So when you give food, and we'll just stick with food right now, if you give food with a stimulus, a CS, then some food, you get a response. That's called excitatory conditioning. It's excitatory because it leads to a response. If you give food... Sorry, give the stimulus and you don't get any food, or don't give any food, you get inhibitory conditioning. It inhibits a response. And in fact, if you do inhibitory conditioning sometimes, let's say you're doing this with a pigeon, you use pigeons a lot in these experiments too, instead of rats, and you get that you show them a little light. So you show them, let's say, a green light means food. They see the green light, they get ready to eat food. When they see the red light, I've seen pigeons actually turn around and walk away from it. Like it's horrible. They don't want to even be near it because it means no food. I've seen them duck their head under their wing like they're hiding. Right? Because they're just learning one, they're predicting the future. One thing means good, one thing means bad. All right? Okay so far? Very good. So this is really pretty basic, as you can see. I mean, and it's also, as I said, I mean, I'm not going to deny this. It's very straightforward, and it's almost kind of boring. And it sounds like something that, I mean, I was talking about Pavlov, was a guy who did his work in the 20s. You know, and this is in the teens, long time ago. See, I think all this work's all done. It's actually been updated quite a bit by people like Ruscorla and another guy named Wagner, and they took into account the idea, the way I've been talking about the animal predicting the future. They talked about sort of predictability. They also talked about what they called associative strength. Associative strength just means any stimulus can only support so much learning. And this can actually be shown, I can show these two things the idea of predictability, looking at how events correlate, and I'll show you an example of that. And then I'm going to show you something called blocking, which shows you about associative strength. Okay? So I'm going to talk about two different things now. They're both sort of Rescorla things. One's Rescorla Wagner-ish, and one of them is just Bob Rescorla. So they're talking now about associative strength and predictability, kind of the way I've been saying things, instead of the CS leads to the US. And that's it. So let's look at this. Remember I said S minus just means you get nothing, S plus means you get something. You're comparing two groups of animals. One group, the animal gets CS plus, oh sorry, CS plus, CS plus, CS plus, CS plus, CS plus. Eventually the animal, and we could pretend this is salivary conditioning in dogs, the animal learns that the tone, if that's the case, predicts food. The animal responds. The way we used to do control groups, I shouldn't say we because this came out before I was born, was the other group you're comparing to is given CS is nothing. CS predicts nothing. CS predicts nothing. CS predicts nothing. CS nothing. What the animal's learning there is that the CS predicts an absence of something. The way you really should do a control group, we even call this a Rescorla control nowadays, is half the time the CS predicts food, the other half the time the CS doesn't predict food. Oh, and you don't do it in a pattern, plus, minus, plus, minus, plus, minus. The animals would figure that out. So you do it, you know, plus, plus, minus, 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 plus, minus, minus, plus, 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 minus, 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 plus, 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 you know, and make it even. What the animal actually learns here now is that literally the CS is inconsequential. Those are two different things. Learning that it predicts a lack of something, as you have at the top, is different than saying there's no relationship between these two things. So this is sort of how we do things nowadays. It's very clever. Rescorla, clever guy. So that's the idea of correlation of events, two things correlating together. It's like that correlation kind of stuff we talked about earlier in the course. Now, the other neat thing, this experiment, this was originally done by a guy named Kamen in 1969. What we have here, we have two possible CSs. One is a light and one is a tone. Okay? Just ignore this group at the bottom here. Here's the control group. Phase one, they don't have a phase one. Phase two, they have a light and a tone together. So at the same time as the light's being played, being shown, a tone. It starts at the same time as the light and ends at the same time. And just near the end of that, you get an unconditioned stimulus. Now let's play the tone by itself. The test then is tone alone, which of course was with Macaulay Culkin. Then it was Home Alone. So you play the tone by itself. What do you get? You get a conditioned response. Except for the fact that we have what's called here a compound stimulus of a light and tone together, this shouldn't surprise anybody, right? This makes complete sense. Okay? You get the same thing if you played the light by itself. You get a response. Now let's look at this group, the blocking group. In the blocking group, we do just the light by itself and the US. And we do that until we get to asymptote. Now we do light and tone together with the US. So they've had something beforehand. One group has nothing, the other group has light plus. Now, we play the tone by itself, and we get no conditioned response. The light, it's called blocking, because the light has blocked conditioning to the tone. This is this idea of associative strength. The US, which is the plus sign here, can only support so much conditioning. What's happened is the light has used up all the conditioning. That's what it says in there in Rescorla and Wagner's mathematical model that we will not discuss in this class. It's really simple math, but we're not going to do it in here. Take 3306, the learning class with me, and you will learn all about that. And we will spend days playing with that model. It's really, really simple, beautiful little mathematical model. Okay. I'm sure I'm really selling it. We're going to talk about mathematical models of learning. Now, think about this just from the animal's perspective. What's it learned here? Light predicts a US. Let's pretend it's food. It's not. It's much more complicated than that, but it works with food, so let's pretend. Light predicts food. Great. That's what the animal's learned. Now you give it light and tone together with food. What's the animal learned about? Well, it already knows that light predicts food. What's it going to learn about tone? It's going to learn, who cares? I already know light predicts food. It ignores the tone. That's basically what's happened here. This went against everything that everybody thought would happen. Because everybody said, well, of course, you've got more pairings of light and the US, light and, let's say, food. You should get a stronger response. Not none, but you get none. Wow. That's cool. It's a very clever experiment, actually. Some of the most clever experiments in all of psychology are done in classical conditioning. It's hard to believe, as it may seem. Questions about that? Does that make some sense? Wow, okay. You guys amaze me. And see, if you were all like failing the course or something, I think you were all kind of dim, but you're doing really, really well on the tests, so I think you're all just smart. Okay. So other cool stuff in classical conditioning. This isn't also just a many trial phenomenon. Right? It's not just like, remember it was 22 trials to get the salivary conditioning. If you do something called a taste or a flavor aversion, or let's even more general call it a food aversion. A guy named John Garcia discovered this. What you do is you take a rat and you give it a novel flavor, a flavor it's never eaten before, chocolate. Okay? And an hour later, you make the rat sick. There's a lot of ways to make rats sick. One of them is give them lithium chloride. That'll make them sick. Another way is to you give them motion sickness. You literally take the rat, you put it in your hand, and you sort of spin it around like a windmill. Gives them motion sickness. It's like a 10-ticket ride at Disneyland for the rat. Or you make them listen to Nickelback. Threw that in. That should make everybody sick. So you... Next day, 24 hours later, give them a choice between chocolate and some other food, and they won't eat the chocolate. They are averse to the flavor. They will not touch it. Has to be a novel flavor. Rats are cool that way. When they encounter something they've never eaten before, they eat a little tiny bit of it, and then they wait. Why? Rats are cooked up kind of funny. Rats can't vomit. If you eat something and it makes you sick, your body kicks it out. When that happens with rats, they just get sick and die. So they have this really cool behavior. They just eat a little tiny bit of something. But if they eat a little tiny bit of something and you make them sick, they just don't eat it anymore. Rats are smart. You know what's really cool about this, by the way? If you do this and the other rats see this rat looking ill, they go up and they smell its breath, and then they'll avoid what the other rats eating ate. This, by the way, again, happens on one trial. One trial. And what's called the interstimulus interval, the time between the CS and the onset and the US onset. Right? So if we went back here, that's the time between here, the CS onset, and the UCS onset. We usually measure that in milliseconds. This is hours. This can be a day later with one pairing. You might have this. This may have happened to you, right? You ever have something that makes you ate it or you drank it and you got sick and you know it wasn't that thing that you had that made you sick, but you now can't eat it anymore, right? A lot of us get those to alcohol, but not to alcohol, to flavors of alcohol, right? A lot of people say, oh, I can't drink tequila. I got sick on it once and I can't even smell it. Tequila is one you hear a lot. Why is that? It's a novel flavor. Most of us don't drink tequila a lot. Or gin, something with a very intense flavor. You don't say, oh, I can't drink anymore, I get sick. You say, I can't drink gin. Right? Oh, you drink beer and wine and vodka and scotch. No gin, though, man. I got sick drinking gin once. I can't even look at a gin bottle. I was like that when I was younger. I couldn't look, but I've worked on it, and I can now. Worked really hard, did a lot of drinking. I'm kidding. Okay, I'm not kidding about the gin thing. When you think about it, though, it's not the tequila that made you sick. It's the alcohol in the tequila that made you sick. Right? There's nothing special. Don't tell me there's something special about tequila. There's nothing special about tequila. Except that it tastes great with lime, some salt, and a little triple sec. So it's one trial. You know what's really neat? If you do this with birds, it's not the flavor, it's the color of the food. They learn in one trial to avoid the color of a food they've eaten. Think about it, though. Birds aren't big on flavor. They don't taste... Well, they taste good if you eat them, but they aren't good at tasting. Right? You don't think of birds sniffing stuff out. Birds do things by sight. So with birds, they learn about it through color. Other animals take advantage of this. Monarch butterflies. It's a great evolutionary reason why a monarch butterfly is so brightly colored. You eat one monarch butterfly, if you're a bird, and it makes you sick, you never eat another one. That's neat. This has showed up in most every species. Classical conditioning, not the taste aversion stuff, but classical conditioning has showed up in pretty much every species that's ever been tested. Vertebrate and invertebrate. I can tell you, by the way, that invertebrates don't show blocking. I don't know why. Association of events is a pretty darn important thing. The idea of being able to predict the moment-to-moment future is really important. So it makes, evolutionarily, right? So it makes a lot of sense that most animals can do this. These methods of classical conditioning have been adopted for application in clinical settings, applied settings. It works. This is how you get rid of phobias. This is how you get rid of phobias. All you do is you teach people a relaxation technique. So you teach them how to do sort of self-relaxation, and then you, so that now is going to be your unconditioned stimulus. Your conditioned stimulus is going to be a snake. And you pair snakes with relaxation. What do people eventually learn? Snakes relax them. This is the most successful kind of therapy, in fact, that exists. It can be done in a couple of sessions kind of thing, and so it makes it cheaper, and it works. Pretty amazing. So if you're afraid of spiders, snakes, the dark, these things can all be treated really easily with no drugs and really cheaply. A couple sessions, it's going to cost you maybe a couple $100, and your spider phobia will be gone. And that's totally just using classical conditioning. The other way you can go is aversive counter conditioning. Let's say something you like a little too much. And you might say, well, I like Coca-Cola too much. Nah, it's not a problem. What if you like child pornography too much? Which is like just at all. And you've been, you know, you're a bad person. You're one of these bad pedophile types. What happens here? Well, it's a hard thing to treat. One thing that's been tried, and it's had some success, is you pair pictures of children, you show people pictures of children, and you make them smell rotten hamburger. Or you pair pictures of children, literally, I'm not making this up, with a shock to their genitals. Which to me sounds like just something you should do to pedophiles, but that's a whole other thing. It kind of works. It doesn't work. Aversive things never work as well as what are called appetitive things, things that feel good. They don't support conditioning as well, but it's been tried. It's also been tried with alcohol abuse. People that drink too much, they take a drug called antabuse that stops the one of the enzymes in the alcohol metabolic pathway, and it basically turns every drop of alcohol you drink into formaldehyde. So if you take a little sip of alcohol, it immediately becomes, because that's actually part of the alcohol metabolism, but it doesn't then get broken down. So basically you take a sip, and that's like you've just been drinking formaldehyde, which will make you violently ill very quickly. It's a way to try to treat, to get people to find alcohol unpleasant. Questions on that? All right, moving along. So that's classical conditioning. And as I said, if you took the learning course, you spend about two-fifths of the course on classical conditioning. There's a whole other kind of conditioning, so called operant conditioning. Pavlovian conditioning, as you know now, involves associating a stimulus, a CS, with a UCR, or a UCS. It might be, it's a long story, what's the animal associating? UCS with CS is associating CS with UCR, but we know that it's something that's sort of hardwired and we're kind of rewiring it. The response is elicited. In other words, it's brought out. And there's a lot of different ones you can use. There's eye blink conditioning. This is done with, I play a tone, and while the tone's playing, I put a puff of air in your eye, and you blink. And then after a couple of times, actually, I play the tone and you blink. Salivation, which is the one we've been using, our running example, the classic Pavlov example. These don't sound a lot like the kind of behaviors we do on a daily basis, though, do they? No. There's some of that, right? There's no doubt. It's probably a lot more than we even could imagine, but it's not like complicated things like we would normally do. A guy named B.F. Skinner called these things respondents. So I talked a bit about Skinner at the beginning of the course. He said these were kind of automatic or innate things that have just been hooked up a little bit differently. A stimulus now predicts them, changes the sort of wiring, kind of. Okay. Call those respondents. Skinner, on the other hand, said that, let's look at operants. This is now associating a behavior with its outcome. The original idea came from a guy named Thorndike, who everybody called the law of effect. And what Thorndike said, what Thorndike did is he took cats and he put them in these puzzle boxes. These little boxes that had like, a little thing that the cat could step on, and it had a little lever the cat could push and a little chain it could pull on, but the cat is locked in a box. Cats don't like being locked in boxes. They start running around, and eventually, mistakenly or just in their crazy frenzy, will pull on the little chain, and the door opens, and they get out, and they get something to eat. Now you put them back in the box, close it up. They get all crazy. Now it's a little more likely now that they're going to pull on that chain because something good came from it. The effect of pulling on the chain got them out of the box and get some food. So Thorndike called that the law of effect, the idea that the outcome of a behavior if it's positive, it makes that behavior more likely. So, but you have to do this. Think about how this works. You have to stand there and put the cat back in, then wait, then stand there and put the cat back in. What Skinner developed was what he called an operant box, or people call a Skinner box, to study this kind of learning. It looks kind of like this. This is one for a rat. What you have here, the rat can push on a little lever to get food down here. That would be water there. That's a water feeder thing. This is for food, so the rat can push on a little bar, and if he's pushed on it enough times, he gets something to eat. You can also do something negative. You see those bars on the floor? You can electrify them, so if the animal does something, it gives a zap. It's not enough that it really hurts the animal. It is, however, rather unpleasant. Whenever I've hooked those up, the way I always tested it was, you keep turning the dial on the shock generator, I can feel that. Okay, that'll be enough for a rat. So now, you can put the animal in and walk away. Because every time the animal pushes the little bar, he gets some food. Push the bar, he gets some food. Beautiful. I don't now have to worry about, every time he gets out of the box, I put him back in the box. I also have something nice I can measure. How many times does the animal respond per unit time? Per minute, you could say. And probably more responding. We could look at differences in responding over time to see how much learning there's been. It's a very clever idea. Way to go, BF. How do you get the animal, however, to push the bar at the beginning? Rats don't normally push a little bar. Oh, it's easy. What you do is this you do by yourself, like you do interacting with the rat. You put the rat in the box, and every time he gets closer to the bar, you push a little button in the feeder, shoots some food out. And every time he gets closer, you give him some more food. And every time he gets closer, you get some food. And eventually, he's going to get so close that he pushes the bar. And it's like, oh, good, my work here is done. Now the rat will just push the bar. That's called shaping through successive approximations. I'm shaping the animal to do something by getting closer and closer to what the animal you want the animal to actually do. There is, however, there are ways to kind of cheat at this. This is what we used to do. You put the rat in there and you put peanut butter on the bar. And they run over there right away. Or with pigeons, because you get them to peck at these little lighted discs. Because it's all done in the dark with pigeons, and they just see this disc and they peck at it, they get food. What do you do with pigeons? Oh, you just take some grain and you tape it to the disc. They can't get the grain out, but they peck at it like crazy. Then they see the feeder operating. You can get it done in 10 minutes. If you're lucky. If you get a stupid pigeon, you have to do it through shaping. So what Skinner said is when you give, say, food after a behavior, let's call that a reinforcer. So a reinforcer is an event that increases responding. The event in this case typically is going to be food. Sometimes water, though working with water is kind of hard to work with. Because when you make you have to make the animal hungry to make this happen. Not super hungry, but enough that that the food means something. So you sort of give him, he hasn't been fed today. So he'll work for food. If you do that with water, they also don't don't eat enough if they don't drink, and it's kind of dangerous. So people typically don't use water. A negative reinforcer is something that when you remove it, it causes an increase in responding. Okay? Primary reinforcers have intrinsic biological value. Food and water. Access to mates. Those have biological value. Animals, including us, will work for those things. We do stuff for them. And that's typically what you would use in these experiments. Almost always food. You okay with that so far? That makes some sense, right? Secondary reinforcers are learned. We learn that the animal will actually, for example, work for the sound of the feeder operating because it's heard through classical conditioning when the feeder's operating, little clicking noise, it gets food. So they'll work for the click. We work for money, right? We use money to buy food and shelter and other biologically important things. Money, when you think about it, biologically, intrinsically, is meaningless. You can't live on money, but you can exchange it for food and water and access to mates, I guess, depending on what part of town you're in. While we can give reinforcement immediately, we can, you know, every time the animal pushes the bar, it gets food. Bar, food, bar, food. We can do that. We don't. We tend to give them on schedules. Think about this. Are you paid constantly when you're at work? Well, no. Imagine if I was standing up here lecturing and the whole time Dr. Ross, the president, was tossing loonies at me to keep me working. That would make her, I think, a little bit busy because there's more than just me around here. And secondly, I would probably tell her to leave because she should stop throwing things at me. Schedules, in fact, are more effective at maintaining learning. weren't maintaining responding. It's very cool. So, we can do different schedules of reinforcement. A fixed interval schedule is the first response after a given interval is rewarded. So, we wait for 10 seconds to elapse, and the first time after 10 seconds the animal pushes the little bar, we give him some food. We'll call that an FI-10. We get what's called an FI scallop, and I guess it's called that because the responding, this is time going across here, across this, the x-axis, and here this is number of responses. And as you see, this is when a reinforcer is given, a little dash. And you know why it goes down like this? Because these things used to actually be done with pens. There'd be a little pen that would go up every time the animal pushed the bar, and a rolling piece of paper would go across. We collect the data with computers now. So I guess it's called scallop because it's kind of shaped like the edges of a scallop shell. You know, like the shell gasoline? That's the only thing I can figure. What happens is the animal responds more and more the closer to the amount of time that has elapsed. The closer you get to the fixed interval, excuse me, you get more responding. The cool thing is we can use this to tell how well animals tell time. Because what we could do is just leave out the reinforcer and then just see where they respond the most. And they're really good at it. We all are. So are any animal. Here, let's think of an example. What if I had... You know, it's a weird thing to think. Any event that increases behavior is a reinforcer. So you know what tests are? They reinforce studying behavior. They're reinforcers. I know they don't feel like it. And they're actually positive reinforcers because they increase studying behavior. If I told you after every second class there'd be a quiz, if I said that, you would study. You'd probably study a little bit and keep it going. But the night before, you'd study the most. Right at the right time, right? We can also do what's called a variable interval schedule. This is like an FI. It's all about intervals, but the interval just varies with a given average, and that scallop now disappears. So instead of every 10 seconds, it's on average every 10 seconds. So 2 seconds, 8 seconds, 7 seconds, 13 seconds, 12 seconds, 8 seconds, 15, 5, 19, 1. Those numbers should all average out to 20, to 10, if I did my math in my head went along. What happens now? It's unpredictable. Remember, the animal's predicting the future. Skinner would never say that. That would have made him angry. That sound you hear is him spinning in his grave, because that's an internal mental event. Remember that from the beginning of the course. But the animal responds now steadily. Think of instead of if I said, I'm going to give you a quiz every second class, what if I said, I'm going to give pop quizzes whenever the hell I felt like it? You'd be studying all the time. You'd never know when I was going to give you a quiz. Right? I never do that because it means that I have to sometimes, usually by the end of the term, I go, oh my God, I said I was going to give 7 of them, I've only given 3. Uh-oh. I got to make up a whole bunch of quick ones. These are the things you learn after a while doing the job. So that, as you can see, that's going to maintain responding. Right? If you think of this, does anybody here have an Xbox 360? Yeah, very good. You know about achievements? You know you play for achievements for no reason because all they are stupid points you get? You know what they are? That's what they are. And I know that they're that because I know the guy that developed them, and his training is all in animal learning. He's got a PhD doing animal cognition, just like I do. And I met him at a conference, and we were talking, and we had exactly the same kind of training. And I said, aren't achievements just... He said, yeah, they're just an interval schedule. It's just to get people to keep playing for no reason. By the way, my Gramer score is almost at 12,000. Just saying. Red Dead Redemption. Oh, that is a game. It's brand new, and it's brand awesome. And I am now in Mexico. It's great. Just got into Mexico this morning before I came to work. Everybody, those of you that don't have one, you know, you guys can just not pay attention, but we're having some fun here. So add me, D. Broadbeck, if you want to play at some point. Play you. little Modern Warfare 2, a little Battlefield Bad Company 2. Oh, Call of Duty Black Ops. Have you seen the trailer? Oh, very excited. But they are, literally. Achievements in the Xbox 360 are literally an interval schedule, and that's why he developed it, because he said it will maintain playing behavior. We can also do things on a ratio. It's a ratio of responses to reinforcers. So reinforcements given after a given number of responses. This is a little less smooth. What happens here is the animal takes a little post-reinforcement pause and then starts responding again. So you don't. What the animal has to be doing here not is not keeping track of time. They have to be keeping track of number. How many responses have I made? And you might say, animals can count? Well, kinda. If you find that interesting at all, go on upstairs on the fifth floor. You will see a couple of papers on the wall, one of them by me and one of them by Dr. Keough, about counting and timing in pigeons. Some stuff that both of us have done. They can kind of count. We know they can keep track of time. Takes a break, starts responding. This is kind of like, you know, you got to do. If you've ever done something like as a kid where you were doing like piecework, like stuffing envelopes, things like that, and you know you got paid for 100, you'd stop at 100 and you take a little break and then you stuff another 100 more. A variable ratio schedule is after a varying number of responses with a given average. And again, you get very steady and high levels of responding. This is a slot machine. That's what that is. There is no system to playing slot machines. There's nothing like that. They're random events. But have you ever been to a casino and watched the people just pumping quarters into those machines? Because every so often, they get a reinforcer. Oh, look, money. That's what that is. This is the hardest thing to break. It's hard to break people of this because they do get reinforced, and it's unpredictable. You never know when you're going to get the payoff. So they just keep pumping quarters and pushing the button. Pump the quarters. Right? Then they get angry when someone else comes along, puts one quarter in and wins a bunch of it, and they, that was my machine, those are all my quarters. You know those kind of pathetic people? There is no system to beat a slot machine. You want to play something in a casino, go play blackjack, go play poker, at least take some skill. This is fun, those things are fun, if you realize you cannot have a system to beat them. All right. And if you've seen people playing gambling machines, poker sort of machines, those machines, or any of them, they're variable ratio schedules, that's all they are. And gambling is so hard to break from people, probably because it's a variable ratio schedule. Right? You do win now and then when you gamble. You do. It's bound to happen. Any questions about that? Skinner figured really these schedules and a whole bunch of other really complicated ones I'm not going to talk about. There's a book. It's this thick. It's called Schedules of Reinforcement, Furster and Skinner, 1957. If you want to fall asleep one night, get a copy of that, Pavlov's Conditioned Reflexes, and just read those. You'll be asleep in about 10 minutes. He thought, basically, this operant conditioning could explain virtually all behavior, even in humans. That let's not worry about internal mental events and all this stuff. It's all conditioning. A punishment, on the other hand, is when I give an event and it decreases behavior. So, dog starts to pee on the floor and you kick it in the head. That's punishment. That's not negative reinforcement. Negative reinforcement is something that you remove that makes behavior more likely. Those are two different things. The thing about punishment is that, The but thing about punishment is you have to give punishment. Unlike reinforcement, which doing it on a schedule works better. Right? It actually works better because it's unpredictable and maintains behavior. It's if you've got kids and you want them to keep doing their homework, now and then say, you really did a good job on that today. Let's go to McDonald's. Kids will work for McDonald's. Hell, I'll work for McDonald's. If you did it every single time, it doesn't work, right? So schedules work well. With punishment, on the other hand, you have to. You have to constantly, every single time the behavior you don't like shows up, you have to give that behavior. You have to give that punisher. And you have to give it right away. So it takes constant monitoring. You can't come in the door if your dog has pooped on the floor and kick it in the head. Well, you can, I guess it's your dog, but it's not gonna, the only thing the dog's gonna learn there is, that guy's scary. It's not gonna learn not to poop on the floor. The only time the punishing will work there is if you follow the dog all day long, as soon as it starts to poop on the floor, you kick it in the head. That'll work. But you can't do this thing. People say, you know, you hit it and then you rub its nose in it. That's just stupid. The dog's gonna learn to hate you. That's what it's gonna learn. Right? So it takes this constant monitoring. What do you learn as a kid when you're if you get punished for something? You learn what? You learn don't get caught. Right? That's what you learn. We all know that. You know what actually works better with kids? Is reinforcing them unpredictably when they do something you like, because it's going to maintain behavior. If you reinforce them for things you like, they can't be doing things you don't like. Weird, eh? Being nice to your kids now and then is better than hitting them. Besides the fact that it's just mean and evil to hit your children. That was a bit of an editorial, but the other stuff is learning theory. It's real. Right? So punishment does work. I'm not denying it, but you have to do it at full intensity every single time. And that's almost impossible. It's almost impossible to do that. It can be done, but you have to constantly walk around following your kid. How many of us as little kids remember that? Because why can't you give it on a schedule? Wouldn't it work better on a schedule like reinforcement? Well, think about it. Let's say if you got your mouth washed out with soap every time you swore, that is pretty mean. But let's, you know, it probably would maintain stop swearing around your parents. By the way, you swear at school, wouldn't you? But what if your mom said, every 10 times you swear, you get your mouth washed out with soap? Well, you effing bitch. You'd say to her and go, well, that's only two. So I got seven more that are free. Right? So it's not going to work on a schedule. So it's so different than reinforcement. It's almost like it's the opposite. Instead of, it's got to be on a schedule. It shouldn't be on a schedule punishment. It has to be on a full intensity after every single behavior right away. So. But it does work. I'm not denying it. It's impractical. And dare I say, oftentimes immoral. But it'll work. All right. Just operant conditioning. Well, all this conditioning stuff, remember the cognitive revolution? We talked about that. We talked about the history of psychology, right? We said that after the war, there was... People were using basically rudimentary computers to break German and Japanese codes. We had the stuff with HM with his brain, you know, and how it was part of his brain was missing, and it ended up that he couldn't form new long-term memories. You put all this stuff together, and people started thinking about thinking, not just about reinforcement. Same thing happened with animal learning. A guy named Tolman is the guy that really got this rocking along. What Tolman did, this is a really neat experiment. It's exceedingly clever. See how old that is? 1930. He's got rats running a maze, and it's a complicated maze. It's like the kind of maze you would have at, in a comic book. You know those kind of mazes? When you were a kid, you'd do them with a pen. You know those kind of mazes? But it's a rat, and it's, you know, an actual built maze. At the end of the maze, there might be food. There's a common way we used to look at animal learning. This is number of errors. These are basically just wrong turns the animal takes. So the higher the number, the worse. And this is number of days the rat ran. Once a day, and at the end he gets cheese. Here's the standard way it works with food. It goes down. Yet another group with no food at all was never given food. Well, they're pretty steady. Then he's got a group given no food, but then on day 11, they're given food. There's day 11. So see, they're going along pretty steady, same as the other guys, same level of nothing. On day 12, they know what they're doing. They were never reinforced, ever, for leaving the maze. Yet they clearly have learned the maze. So what Tolman is showing here is that you don't need reinforcement to get learning. Tolman said the animal had learned what he called a cognitive map. Right? Ooh, this would make the Skinner people angry because that's like a map in your head. He also did another one. He showed you didn't even need responding. Because you know what he did? He took rats, and I'm not making this up because it sounds like I'm making it up. He took rats, put them on little like carts, and he drove them around the mazes. So they didn't even respond. They didn't even run around. He just drove it. It's Gleitman and Tolman, I think, in 1955, driving them around on this little maze, showing them where everything was in the maze. Then he puts them on the maze, and of course, they make some mistakes. They find out there's cheese in the end. The next day, they're perfect. You didn't even have to respond to learn something. That's pretty cool. And I used to have a picture of this, of a rat on a little cart being pushed around a maze. And I don't know what the hell ever happened to the picture I had. This is called latent learning. The animal has learned something, but it's latent. It's in there, but it hasn't shown anything, right? Because you can see, without giving the food on day 11, the animal isn't showing any learning. On day 12, ha! I know how to get out of this maze. That is neat. All right. Questions about that? Do you understand the Tolman experiments? Pretty cool. Tolman was a hell of a guy. Neat guy. He protested World War I. He wouldn't sign the loyalty oath saying he wasn't a communist, even though he wasn't a communist after World War II, because he just says, none of your business. He was a cool guy. Something else happens. These are people, the Breelands. Early 60s, they trained with Skinner. All this just reinforcement stuff. They trained with Skinner, but instead of becoming academics, they went into advertising. And what they were making was basically window displays for different businesses. It used to be that there'd be big store windows and there'd be like a little diorama of some sort. That was before the websites. So, what they're doing is they got a... No, not yet. They've got... A bank has hired them to make a neat little kind of demonstration, little display in their window. What the bank has done is said, oh, you know what we'll do? We will have a raccoon, this is what the Breelands said, put money in a little piggy bank out front. People will see that. We can train it to do that, and that'll be easy. And it's cute because they have the little masks like they're little robbers. It'll be awesome. So they train the animal through successful approximations to drop this wooden coin in a piggy bank. They do it for a while, then they stop and just start taking the coin and rubbing it, but never putting it in the bank. They said, oh, okay, it didn't work. Let's try a pig. Oh, pig, piggy bank, that's cute. So they take the pig, train it up through successive approximations. The pig carries this wooden coin in its mouth, drops it in the bank a couple of times. It's great, everything's awesome. Now the pig doesn't do that anymore. The pig starts pushing the coin around on the ground with its snout. They called this instinctive drift, that the animal was now treating the object, the coin, as food, as almost like it represented food, which is so not Skinner, right? Like it's representing something. To show you how ingrained the idea of Skinner's notions were, though, their book that they wrote was called The Misbehavior of Organisms. Like, they're not supposed to do that. It's pretty funny. It was just sort of a weird thing. Mid-70s come along. Dave Alton and Samuelson come along and they invent this maze called a radial maze. This is a radial maze. This maze is looks pretty simple. You've got food at the end of each arm, and you got all these spokes radiating out like the spokes of a wheel. Arms are maybe 30 centimeters, no, more than that, 50 centimeters long. The rat's task is to go from the middle of the maze, go to the end of each arm, get the food. Sounds pretty easy, and it is, except, and of course, how would you and I do it? I would start at the top one and just keep going right till I was done. That's not what the rats do. They go kind of haphazardly all over the place. But they don't make mistakes until, of their first eight choices, seven of them are correct. They're remembering where they had food, where they've been. And in fact, they do better if there's all kinds of cues in the room, things hanging up on the wall. And they do this with memory. Because you might think, oh, they're doing it with smell. They're doing it with smell. Well, you know, one of the neat experiments in the Olton Samuelson paper is that they took a whole bottle of Old Spice and just poured it on the maze. So there's no way the rat could smell anything. So Dave Olton's lab smelled like somebody's uncle for a couple of months. The rats were still just fine, almost perfect. They're doing this with memory, not with just like stimulus response. Later on, Stephen van der Waal found out that something that seemed really unlikely that an animal could do with like just operant conditioning. Clark's nutcrackers are birds that grow in the American Southwest. That's where they live. But up in sort of the mountains where it's cold. In the fall, a Clark's nutcracker stores 30,000 seeds in a 40-kilometer radius. That's like what? If we were to draw a circle from here to what? Thessalon? That's the crow flies kind of thing? In a circle. I challenge you to hide 30,000 things. And then 6 months later, find 25,000 of them. Oh, and you can't use a GPS and you can't write it down. You just have to remember where they are. Wow. So these animals were doing this through memory, and they were then brought into the lab, and it turned out they have these incredible memories. It's not about stimulus response either. It's about remembering where stuff is. Just like Tolman did, right? It's about space. Sarah Shuttleworth did similar stuff with marsh tits, which are little birds from Britain, and black-capped chickadees. Marsh tits are like little British chickadees. Looking at food storing behavior and finding that chickadees remember where they put food. Finding that chickadees, for example, remember where they put food at the expense of remembering, say, the colors around the area. They remember spatial things more importantly than anything, but that makes sense. Chickadees don't migrate. They stay around in the winter, don't they? When they wake up, if they don't hide food, if they don't find food about half an hour after they've woken up in the middle of the winter, they literally die. So the first thing they do is they wake up and find some food they've hidden, just like a squirrel, that kind of thing. And then they go out and find more food and hide it for the next day. Then they remember, as I said, where it was, not so much other things about a stimulus, the color, etc. That was discovered by one of her graduate students. That's just as I was leaving after I got my PhD. And that's Sarah. Cognition in non-humans now is pretty much a generally accepted thing. And up until the mid-70s, it wasn't. It was the idea... God, I'm losing my voice. I had really bad allergies today because of all that pollen out there. And it's like, I must have sneezed 30 times at the bus stop today. So the idea that there's cognition in non-humans is a generally accepted idea now. So we still, however, use all Skinner's techniques and Pavlov's techniques, and we still even study some of these things. We've branched out now when we study learning in animals. Some things about animal cognition, then. Animals can do some amazing things. That's a very bad picture of my old lab, because it shouldn't be that color. The colors are off. Because that's a Skinner box. But that's one I built, and instead of having little things that the birds peck at, that's a computer monitor with a touch-sensitive monitor, so I could put all kinds of stimuli on there. Animals keep track of time. They can navigate over great distances or short distances. They can remember lots of stuff. The worst thing you can do with a, like I said, maybe a Clark's nutcracker can remember 30,000 seeds. Well, 25,000 recovers 6 months later. Don't try to get inside their heads and figure out how they do it. The only way to do that is through experimentation. You can't introspect and think about what it must be like. But yeah, so like, it's the same kind of technique though. Look, that's like an operant box, except it was for pigeons. But this is a computer monitor, and I could put all kinds, I could put up little colored circles if I wanted to, or really complicated pictures. And I don't know why the color looks like that, it's all off. So Skinner's ideas are out of date, but the Skinner box, for example, is still in use. The ideas of, when I say the ideas, not the schedules in that, but the ideas that we only talk about reinforcement and responses, we don't talk about internal mental events. For the last 10 minutes, I've been telling you about animals' internal mental events. And that all really started with Tolman. All right. Let's apply some of these ideas about learning. So let's apply them. Token economies. Used to be used a lot in psychiatric institutions and in prisons. They aren't really so much anymore. But the idea was you would give people tokens, chips, for doing something you liked. Let's say somebody's withdrawn, socially withdrawn. Give them a token every time they smile. And then they could exchange these tokens, which were like secondary reinforcers, for primary reinforcers like chocolate bars and, for the most part, smokes. Not used so much anymore because now we pay prisoners, not very much, we pay them in prisons, and they aren't used so much in psychiatric institutions anymore. But do you remember ever in school working hard for a star on your test, like a sticker? When you were in like grade 2, grade 3, you'd be all excited and you'd be like, oh, I want to get a sticker this time. And what does that get you? Nothing. But you worked for it. In industrial organizational psychology, which is the sort of psychology of how to make people more efficient and how they work, a lot of psychological principles used here, obviously, but especially learning principles. If we know about how people respond on schedules, we can take a look at trying to maintain optimal levels of working, right? You can also do things like giving people incentives. People come up with a good idea, you pay them. A lot of clinical settings here have used these. There's been tremendous work done with really low-functioning autistic people using reinforcement. So you reinforce. One of the biggest problems that parents have of autistic kids is that autistic kids don't, they don't interact the same way that normal people do. Right? They don't look you in the eye. They don't hug as much, things like that. But they'll do it. So what you do is every time they go to hug you, you give them a spoonful of ice cream. Now, you can't keep doing that or you get really fat kids. But you pair that ice cream, which is a primary reinforcer, with a hug from the parent, secondary reinforcer. Now the kid will work for hugs. And parents want to hug their kids. And this works. This is, you might have heard of IBI, intensive behavioral intervention with autistic people. It's really amazingly effective to get people to not only do positive things, but stop them doing negative things. Because if they're doing positive things, they can't be doing negative things. And in people that are very, there are some people that are autistic pretty severely that are self-injurious. They hurt themselves. Bang their heads against walls, rip out their hair. You know what's done there? If it's a very severe case, you shock them. I know that sounds horrible, but it stops them from banging their heads against walls. Seems to me that might be worth shocking somebody a few times. Plus, you're reinforcing them for good stuff. Amazingly effective. All right. So that's just some of them. We talk about the aversive counterconditioning, things like that. What about observational learning? What about learning by watching? Well, humans can do this. We know that. Right? Very few people watch the Food Network simply because it's fun watching the Food Network. Though sometimes there's some show, our Iron Chef, that's fun. But typically you watch it so you can learn something. Right? Oh, I'm going to make one of those, that kind of thing. So we know that we can do this. There's all kinds of evidence that we learn that way. Right? You can show somebody, even little kids, it was a great experiment by Al Bandura, modeling behavior. So he shows kids, like a, you know, a punching clown? Do you remember those toys? Like a blow-up doll that you punch and it falls down and comes back up? So he showed these little kids one of these punching clowns, or as he called it, a Bobo doll, which I called it a punching clown when I was little. But he shows little four-year-old, three-year-old kids in nursery school one of these things, and he models someone being really mean to it and punching it. The kids then do that. He then has somebody be nice to it and pleasant, and the kids are nice and pleasant to it. He then shows the same thing on film. Ooh. And the kids, same reactions. We know, of course, this also, we have some pretty good idea this happens in orangutans as well. Not with the punching clowns, but, and this is mostly through anecdotal evidence. But a friend of mine did some stuff at a, what is in essence, an acquaintance, not a friend of mine, of in essence a rehabilitation facility for orangutans that have been kept as pets in Southeast Asia. And it's on one of the islands in Indonesia. And what they do is they take these orangutans there, and the orangutans hang out, and they basically are trying to live semi-wildly. And eventually, when they're used to the wild enough, they just leave. So what this person I know was doing was working there, trying to observe this behavior, and she saw some of the strangest things. She saw orangutans painting a building, one of the little buildings at the camp. Nobody gave them any food for painting buildings. But they saw people painting, and then one of the orangutans comes up, picks up a brush, and starts painting. So from then on, whenever they were painting one of the structures, they'd have extra brushes out for the orangutans. Orangutans started brushing their teeth. So, and orangutans don't normally brush their teeth. And they weren't reinforced for this, they just did it. They saw people do it. And I said to her, what happens when an orangutan steals your toothbrush? And she said, if an orangutan steals your toothbrush, you aren't getting it back, and you really don't want it back. She's probably right. One of them even learned how to tie up a hammock with tie knots in a tree, because the orangutan liked lying in the hammock. The best story, though, was the orangutans really liked eating the food that the people ate, which was, cooked. So one day, two orangutans go make a diversion and scare the cooks, because there was a lot of people working at this place, and they're locals, out of the little hut where their little kitchen where they're making the food. Then they go in, they steal a pot, fill it with water, put rocks around it, just like you might put rocks around a fire, and sat there waiting for soup, which of course never arrived because the orangutans aren't smart. They haven't mastered fire or cooking yet. So they learned that all clearly just through watching humans. There's no real data there, but how the hell else could they have done it? So we can do it, we know this, and some of our close relatives, I bet chimps can do it too. I wouldn't be surprised. The question this makes you ask is things like TV violence, video game violence. Does this make people more violent if they see violence on TV? The data here aren't exceedingly clear. I know some of the stuff I've done about video game violence shows that if people play a game violently or play a game not violently, because you have to play the same game or you don't have any control. So we found that there was no effect, no change in people's aggression. The stuff with TV violence and movie violence has basically shown that for a short period of time, there's an increase in likelihood of people being violent. But it's a short period of time. Mostly these things are anecdotal, so you get someone say, oh, a kid robbed a, stole a car, and he plays Grand Theft Auto. Yeah, he also probably drinks water. We don't blame water. So there's not a whole lot of really good data here that there's studies have been done. It's just that it's not 100% ironclad like you seem to hear that it is. So the question is how long lasting. That's the big question, is the effect. The effect's probably there. Now, the other angle then here is, do you censor content, right? Do you say you can't watch this, you can't do that, you can't play that? I'm not saying you should let your, I don't think you should let your kids play Grand Theft Auto. I don't think it's not a game for children. It's a really awesome satire of the United States of America, actually, of Western civilization. But 8-year-olds don't get the satire. They get the, let's run over some hookers. They think that's fun. They don't get the joke. Fair enough. Now, let's say, I've heard this, people say, well, we should just make these things illegal. Now, if you believe that it's like monkey see, monkey do. So if you see something, you will do it. If we see the state censoring stuff, aren't we then modeling anti-democratic behavior? So, I don't know. It seems to me that every time I hear, like, let's say someone says, won't someone think of the children, I suddenly imagine jackbooted thugs walking down the street. I think parents should, yeah, but I don't think the state should, you know. I remember being at a thing once with my daughter was at the university preschool at Western. It was great. I was a postdoc there, so they had this preschool. It's awesome. The nice thing about this preschool was the kids, now and then, there's a one-way mirror, which the kids all figured out, for people to do observational research on these little kids. And I was in the psych department, so I was like, yeah, I'll put my daughter in there. So she went, and they'd have these little resource nights. They'd bring in speakers. It was really, you know, because they're professionals. And this one person came in and started railing against TV violence. And I said, well, sure, yeah, you know, I don't let my daughter watch, and this is, my daughter's 16, so I said, I don't want her to watch NYPD Blue. I don't think she'd want to, which was a violent cop show. I said, and she showed a slide of the Bart Simpson, and she said, here's Public Enemy number one. And I said, what's wrong with The Simpsons? It's my 2-year-old's favorite show. At this point, my wife's starting to hide under the table because she doesn't want to hear the confrontation I'm about to have with this person. And she said, well, he doesn't respect authority. I said, neither do I. So those are my values. She said, and he wins through cheating. I said, have you ever actually watched the program? Bart's a loser, and Homer is a loser. You know who the winners are? Lisa. She always gets stuff done. It actually models really good behavior. And besides, I don't think you should tell me what to do with my kids, because people like you are, like I said, jackbooted thugs. And of course, my wife's going, shut up. Right? And then I brought this up. I said, if we censor things, aren't we showing our kids that it's okay to not have different ideas? And she was like, well, I've never thought of it that way, but I don't think. She didn't talk like that at all, but I'm making her sound really stupid. Well, I don't think so. So, I mean, that's the thing. Is it going to have an effect? Yeah, I think it probably does. Is it long-lasting? No. No. Also, I think it tells us if we actually can do this, we have to be more active parents with our kids. We have to, when we see what they're playing, what they're watching, I get appalled when I'm in EB Games and I see a kid my son's age who's 9 years old who goes and picks up, say, Red Dead Redemption. That's not a kid's game. That's a game for grown-ups. You know, or Modern Warfare 2, the no Russian mission where you have to kill civilians. That's intense if you're an adult. That's a really intense thing. You do this, you're undercover, so you have to do it. Well, you can skip the mission, but it kills the feel of the game. You know, I mean, know what your kids are watching on TV, playing video games, what they're reading. Do that, because you have to realize they will pick up on things. Right? But it's not like it's going to wreck them for life. Because you know what they used to think it would be? Rock and roll. Oh, before that was rap music, then it was rock and roll. And then before that, I think it was comic books and it was movies. And I think back in Julius Caesar's time, it was really nasty scrolls. So I wouldn't worry too much. On that note, any questions or comments about this stuff? As usual, you guys are the quickest class ever. I don't know what's going on, but I think it's fine, because you're all doing very well in the course, so pretty much. So next time we will talk about memories. Take a look at that chapter. Thanks, guys. You say that you know it.
don't say what tomorrow will be. I thought that I'd show it. I guess it's front row. Wait, watch, you'll see. And if you say that you
podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright share alike 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me because I'm reserving that right. Giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.